Father Richard Rohr is a Franciscan monk, a gentle, brilliant, warm-hearted man living in the southern United States and running a retreat center there. One day in his daily meditations, he wrote this for us. As long as Jesus' followers were on the bottom edge of the empire, as long as they shared the rejected and betrayed status of Jesus, they could grasp his teaching more readily. Values like non-participation in war, simple living, inclusivity, and love of enemies could be more easily understood when Christians were gathering secretly in the catacombs when their faith was untouched by empire. When the Christian church became the established religion of the empire, it started reading the Gospels from the position of maintaining power and social order instead of experiencing the profound powerlessness that Jesus revealed. In a sense, Christianity almost became a different religion. Years ago, a friend gave me a collection of beautiful things, bits of poetry and quotations and little philosophical thoughts, some of them profoundly familiar, and you'd know them to see them. They've been made into postcards and the rest, and some surprising little gems that few have ever read. And I take the book out sometimes, and I look through it, and I'm encouraged by it, and I learn new things from it. Well, we have such a book before us today in the book of Proverbs in the Old Testament. It is a collection of Jewish wisdom and wider world advice gathered over time, and it's gathered from both friend and conquering empire. You learn things from whomever you deal with. Well, this book of Proverbs was gathered together in its final form just before the Jewish scriptures were gathered together and put into the Jewish canon where nothing would be further changed. And although I doubt many of us sit at home of an evening leafing through the book of Proverbs, it does contain things that cover most of the areas in our life. Things about God and tribe and community values and relationships and the battles between the genders, yes, they're in there, and sexuality and personal and business ethics and the place of poverty and wealth in the world and the inevitability of sickness and death, all of them contained in the book of the Proverbs. These are the themes for all of us to consider on a cold winter's night. A few verses read this morning are a challenge enough. Did you hear it? Is it better to be respected than to be wealthy? That was one of them. Better to be respected than to be wealthy? A quick response might be, well, living in Canada, we are both respected and wealthy. But that's not the end of the discussion, is it? Somebody sent me a copy of something that he had found interesting, and indeed it was. It said, if you want to get a vision of what the whole world is like in a picture, picture all the population of the world as 100 people, and then you break it down. 6 of the 100 people own 59% of the world's wealth, and they all live in the United States. 80 of 100 of the people live in poverty. 70 of the 100 are illiterate. 50 of 100 are hungry and malnourished every day. 1 in 100 has a university degree. If you can worship without fear on a sacred morning, you are 1 of 3 billion people. If you have food and shelter and a place to sleep, you have more than 75% of the world's population. If you have never known war or deprivation or torture in any form, you are 1 of 500 million people. Now, we can equate wealth with disrespect, and some folk do. If you're wealthy, you don't care. And we can give poverty the benefit of the doubt and say that people who are poor often have integrity, even if you can't see them. But that, too, can be simplistic. And I think to myself, what about philanthropists? There have always been philanthropists among us. There are in the city today, in the world. There have been philanthropists in this church, in this generation, and in the ones that came before. I think of the Andrew Carnegies and the John D. Rockefellers, those who have given foundations and established hospitals and set up universities and support international aid to this day. The Warren Buffetts, the Bill Gates, the Slate family in Toronto, the Kerners of Kerner Hall, the Westons, the Eatons, the Masseys, the Jackmans, we can all name them. There is honor and dishonor in wealth, so it seems. The Wall Street corporate criminals of the 2008 crash seem to be walking around free in their cities these days. And there is honor and dishonor in poverty. It was a poor woman, Rosa Parks, who sat in the front of a bus and refused to walk to the back when so ordered because of the color of her skin, and changed the culture of the world. The quality of the person will shine through, perhaps, through wealth and or poverty. I went to a funeral not so long ago. I just happened to read the name in the newspaper and remembered the man who had died as a young boy. He was a neighbor who lived next door to me when I was a young boy. I was about 5 years older. And he and his brother would come over most evenings and knock on the door and say, could Malcolm come outside and play hockey with the tennis ball? And so we would go out into the backyard, and these two little boys would fire the tennis ball, and I would be the goalie. And I moved, and they went on with their lives, and I hadn't seen them over the years. And then I realized that he had died. He'd had a heart attack and died at 65. Well, I went of the visitation and introduced myself and met members of the family, and most recently his brother, whom I did not meet on that night, slightly older brother, phoned me and said, let's have lunch together, I want to bring you up to date. So he came and spoke to me, we ate together. He was a most interesting world traveler. He said, let me tell you about my brother. My brother was the happiest guy, and he loved restaurants, and he opened two or three restaurants, and he spent all his time at restaurants, and he did very well at it. And then he won $10 million in the lottery. And he set up funds for his children, future education, and their lives together. And then his wife, with whom he had lived for years, married but never been at home because of the restaurants, divorced him. And then at 65, he dropped dead of a heart attack. Well, is it better to have respect, or is it better to have wealth? I don't know. How about the premise that all people, despite their social status and public affect, come from a common source? There is one of the maxims from the Proverbs. The child gazing at the sky, the old woman sitting patting a kitten on her lap, the mother nursing a baby, the scholar savoring a text, the grandfather languishing in a senior's home, all types and all colors and all attitudes, the hoodies and the handguns, the first responders, the overdose victims, all of them from the same source. What do you think of that? We've erected so many fences in our structures and our minds that we may find that hard to believe. These are not of me, we say. These are not mine, we say, when we look at others just across the fence. The letter from James in the New Testament names an underlying attitude that may lurk in every community of faith. Well, it lurks other places as well, but I'm thinking about communities of faith today. Public smiles masking private caution. Those who look better will be treated better than those who look bad. I remember a few years ago, and there are 100 stories of our time here together, there was a young bride who wanted a certain song sung at her wedding. Now, we have a rule of thumb, no karaoke. It has to be live music. But this woman said, well, this song has to be done with a certain background, and it was my aunt's favorite, and my aunt just died, and I promised her that we'd have the song sung, and so we hummed and hawed and wrung our hands and finally said, okay. So the time came for her to sing, and she stood up in the pulpit, and the music started through the church speakers, and she took the microphone, and she began to sing, and she was halfway through the first verse when someone from the park burst through the church doors and started swearing in a loud voice with great and unspeakable epithets, rah, 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 from the back. The ushers raced from the front to tackle him. The woman stopped singing, and the music went on. Well, she didn't know where she was, and we didn't know where he was, and All I knew was the bride was still standing in front of me, but I didn't realize why. And then I thought, we have to have better protocols around here. And another day, when we were all worshiping in here, someone came up from the park and kicked the front door so hard, knocked the center panel right out of it and right up against these inner doors. And one of our care staff went after the man and followed him all the way over to the Young Dundas Square, talking to the police the whole time. And the police said, he sounds dangerous. Stay away from him. We'll take it from there. The need for protocols. And early on, there was a man who sat two-thirds of the way back, don't get any ideas back there, and he started lighting matches during the service. And he'd light a match, and he'd blow it out, and then he'd light another match, and he'd blow it out. The chair of our board, a lovely young woman, a psychologist, took a look at him across the aisle and went over to him and said, I really wish you wouldn't light the matches. And he kept lighting them. And then finally she grabbed him by one wrist, and he still kept lighting them with the other hand. And the last time we saw them, she was straddling him, holding both wrists back while the ushers came running. We need protocols around here. And we do have protocols. We know who to welcome and we know who to watch, and we try to get it right most of the time, but they're there. I remember a man came in one morning and started railing and ranting. I was standing at the back of the church, railed and ranted the church as this and that and the other thing, and I got into it, which is unusual. I said, oh yeah, well let me tell you what you are, and we went on for that for about 5 minutes, and as he was turning to leave in a huff, I caught myself and I said, my goodness gracious, what did you just do? And I ran up to the man and I said, excuse me, I need to apologize to you. I was totally out of line, and you caught me by surprise. This is not who I am. And he turned and said, I apologize to you. This is not who I am either. And then there was another little moment where we both didn't know exactly who we were, but we knew it wasn't the things we had first exhibited. Well, we do have security protocols. Now, James goes on to suggest, unsettlingly, that God is more active in our poverty than in our guarded self-sufficiency. What do you think about that? We spend our whole lives being guarded and self-sufficient, but James is suggesting God is more active in our vulnerability. And this turns our presumptions on our head. God works with the poverty in us, says James. Our faults, our weaknesses, our uncertainties. When we are real and unmasked, it is then that we are the apple of God's eye. Well, I don't spend all this money on hairspray and makeup to know that it is my vulnerability that appeals to God. I don't know about you. It's our elitism and personal distinctions that kill the dream and do the harm. When we feel that it's our tribe that's true and it's our destiny that's manifest, we light fuses of exploitation and imbalances and war with no compassion and no sense of mutuality. It makes for a very dangerous world. Well, what level is your social prejudice, do you think? What's your gut reaction before your mind comes into play to temper you down a bit? Do we take a look at someone and say instinctively, there goes the neighborhood? Or do we say, there goes my peace of mind, there goes my cultural privilege? Do you feel the hair on the back of your neck standing up? Do you say, there goes the prominence of my religion, there goes the ease of my day, there go the dreams of my country? I must be watchful of my own prejudices. I must take time to be watchful of them because they are in me. I was reading Phyllis Earhart's book on the United Church of Canada and its formation, and one of the little throwaway lines in it is that the United Church of Canada was first gathered in its roots to form a British phalanx against outside invaders. And the outside invaders they had in mind were Highland Scots. I can understand that. Highland Scots. Well, thank God they broke that barrier down, or I probably wouldn't be here. But you have to watch your prejudices. When Dr. Marvin McMickle was here, he is an Afro-American principal of the seminary in Syracuse, New York, a published author, a teacher of theology, and a marvelous American preacher. He was here as our guest, and he was telling some of us at another event that when he first came to Toronto and got into the elevator at his hotel to come down for breakfast, as soon as he stepped into the elevator, the woman who was standing in there pulled her purse closer to her because he was a 6-foot-5-inch black man. He said, I wasn't interested in her purse. I wanted to know how my Cleveland Cavaliers had done the night before. He said, when I sit among you, you see me as an author and a preacher and the principal of a major American seminary. You see me as someone who is a friend and someone who is interested in the honor and glory of God in Jesus Christ. But as soon as I step out on the street, I am nothing but a fearsome black man. Nothing but a fearsome black man. So how do you do with the prospect of us all coming from one common source? Hard to maintain sometimes, isn't it? Have you been hurt by somebody? Have you been scammed by them? Have you been left feeling foolish? Young ministers are often suckers for this. I remember being in the early days and a man came to the door and he said he'd been traveling across the country and other ministers whom he named had helped him and his mother was sick in Nova Scotia and he needed $50 and whatever and I gave him a check for $200 of my own money and wished him on his way. And then later that afternoon, the bank phoned and said, is this check all right? I said, yes, I think it is. And then he went on his way. And then a couple of days later, I came home and my young son said, there was a man at the door today. He wanted a radio. I gave him yours. And then I talked to someone else and they said, that man has traveled all across Canada and has scammed every clergyman from British Columbia to Nova Scotia. It's the same story. He names the five names that you might know but can't get in touch with, and he's always going somewhere you can't check. And that hardened me after that, and I became very, very careful about my dignity and my sense of worth and my sense of righteousness. And I remember people coming to the door here over the years, and we've changed our policy 100 times. No food stamps, no tickets, because you sell them at the corner. A few clothes, but not many. Don't come back here too often. Don't touch anything while you're in the building. It all belongs to us, and so on. And I remember someone wanting money, and I remember on occasion giving them a handful of money out of my own wallet because the story got to me, and then I found out later that the story was a lie, and I think here we go again. Until there was a knock on the door late one afternoon and a man came back and said, do you remember me? And I said, yes, I do. He said, I've come to give you the $100 back. I've found my feet now and I'm so grateful that you gave it to me. Well, what do you do with that? Today we begin our autumn season together. We'll have the study groups and the office rhythm and the musical rehearsals and lots of big anniversary events and visitors arriving and going, and we're going to know some sad moments and some sad partings along the way. It just happens. And the unexpected and expected things of life are going to come knocking at our door. And the doorstep between here and the outside, that doorstep down at the back of the church, will display the difference between a community of faith writing a fresh heart to the vision of Proverbs and a communion of faith refusing the challenge of Proverbs and circling the wagons and protecting our turf at all costs. Howard Thurman, in his book Deep is the Hunger, writes, there is no more exacting enterprise than the conscious quest for precious communication between people. How can I make my meaning clear to you? How can I reveal myself to you so that my understanding of you will be a self-revelation of me? Now, St. Mark fancies that Jesus took a few weeks' holidays. Well, I wanted to play with that a little bit, if I may. It says that Jesus went to Tyre in Lebanon. And I was looking up the distance between Nazareth in Judea and Tyre in Lebanon, and it's 416 kilometers. That's just not a donkey ride up the street for a cold drink. That is a long way from home. So Jesus, according to the story, is taking time to get away from it all. He goes from a little village to a great city with 3,000 years of cultural history where he can lose himself among his friends. Do we not love to do that? The secret hideaway where we can lift off all the layers and just be ourselves. Anonymous, the perfect getaway. What happens in Tyre stays in Tyre, says the sign at the airport. Well, they get to a beachfront cottage, let's say, And there is Jesus sitting in the shade in a wicker chair with a cold drink in his hand, and he's got the sunglasses on and just enjoying some late afternoon rays. And a street woman, a strange woman, some foreigner, some intruder, comes into the midst and says, "Can you help me? I have an abusive son, and he's coming home from God knows where, and every time he comes home, he ruins everything. And my mother is sick right now. I can hardly lift her off the bed. And my daughter is terrified of her brother, and she's locked herself in her room, and I don't know what's going to happen." And Jesus and his friends may say, "Can't you call the police?" "Well, I've called the police over the years. They know him, but it's always too late. By the time they get there, he's done the damage he's going to do." "Well, can't you call on the neighbors? Can't you count on the next door neighbor?" He said, "They've all had the window glass in their houses thickened so they can't hear all the things that go on in my house. We are a house that's known in the neighborhood," she said. "It's violent, it's cruel, it's vengeful, just like my son." "Here we go again," says Jesus. "Look, I'm a stranger," he says. "I don't know you, and I'm tired. And I don't want to get involved. I don't want to get involved, and I'm sorry for you. But I don't want to be part of your concern at the moment." But she persisted. She said, "Look, you're safe here. You have numbers here. You have friends all around you. If I could simply run here, if I could tell my mother and daughter simply that we have a place to go, just a few houses up the beach, if I could tell them that, won't you even give me those crumbs from under your table?" she said. And Jesus and his friends grew quiet. And the host finally said, "She's always been trouble, you know, always. Worst house on the street." And somebody else said, "I hate the violence. This neighborhood is changing so much. We moved here for a little peace and quiet, but I'm afraid to send my children off to school in case they're shot by somebody on the way." And another one says, but she was only asking for crumbs, just crumbs. And together, finally, they went to the woman and they said to her, look, if things go bad, bring your mother and your daughter down the beach to us." And later, around the embers of the fire, Jesus recalled that his mother, when he was a little boy, used to walk him up the hill behind Nazareth and look down on the plain, and she would tell the same story. "Nearly a century ago," she said, "when the Romans first came, they raided and burned and ruined everything in sight. All the fields and the little villages, all the hopes and dreams. They left people dead and wounded, and members of our family, members of our tribe, were lost on those days. And we were desperate, and we were alone, and we were losing hope. And one day, the strangest thing, an old woman, an old witchy woman, the one everyone mocked, the one everyone feared, who lived in the funny little shack up the road, that woman knocked on the door and stretched out her skinny arms and handed in a small basket, and it contained bread and wine and water. And she said, 'The Romans didn't find it under the stairs.'" They all grew silent around the fire, and then one drew water and set it on the table, and one brought out a loaf of bread and placed it on a plate, and one turned down the covers on the three spare beds. And then they filled the oil lamp, and they left it outside on the table, ready to be lit. "Can a little child like me thank the Father fittingly? Yes, oh yes, be good and true, patient, kind in all you do. Love the Lord and do your part. Learn to say with all your heart, 'Father, we thank thee. Father, we thank thee. Father in heaven, we thank thee.'" There's the true song. It balances wealth and character. It unites us with one another in a very deep place. Sing it at the doorsteps you meet today and watch a new world being born.